Hello, and thank you for listening to the Mika podcast, a series in which we talk to people whose expertise and experience is both fascinating and useful. Mika, the Motor Industry Communicators Association, is a professional organisation for all automotive industry communicators across all sectors. If you aren't a member already, you can join at mika.org.uk, where you'll also find a list of the latest training, workshops, networking events and masterclasses. I'm Richard Gotch, and in this episode, I'm pleased to be having coffee with Harry Metcalf, proprietor of the Harry's Garage and Harry's Farm YouTube channels.
As a petrolhead, I've enjoyed Harry's Garage in particular almost since its launch, but it's the numbers that really explain why I'm here today. YouTube has more than 2.5 billion monthly users who collectively watch more than 1 billion videos every day. How many copies does a UK print magazine typically sell? 20,000? 30,000? Harry's Garage has 604,000 subscribers, and channel views can reach 4 million a month. Harry, thank you very much for joining me today.
Pleasure to see you, Richard. Looking forward to it.
You were running Evo when YouTube started to become important to publishers. Can we start with some insights into the challenges of getting the editorial team up to speed with the new techniques? Was it a bit like when the transition from silent movers to talking movers?
Well, I wasn't around quite at that point, and I remember hearing that magazines really changed where you could add colour to a magazine. But YouTube, completely different thing. And I only really knew YouTube on the periphery. When we were researching a story, you'd find someone who'd find a clip of something on YouTube and we'd all go over and have a look. And it wasn't really, when it first, in 2005, it wasn't seen as something that we should get involved with. I think it was the revamp of Top Gear TV, and everybody saw, God, that's a powerful media. Maybe we ought to look at doing videos ourselves. But it was a completely different skill set then. One, the photographers we were using were specialist still photographers, large format cameras and very much bolt-on, etc. Video was another complication and needed a completely different photographer back then. And so it was a slight barrier to entry, wasn't considered. Chris Harris was early on it because he actually bought his own cameras and bolted onto cars and started doing it. For Autocar, that looked successful. So we sort of started looking at it. But what I soon learned was a journalist doesn't automatically make a great presenter. And the true journalists, as we had on Evo on a monthly, this is not a criticism, but they are introverts. They like to think, and they like to think while they express their opinions, and that's why they're writers, because they absorb the information and then turn it into a story. Presenting a video is more instant, and you have to go out there with your thoughts, and it's a harder medium. So it didn't always, just because you're a great journalist, did not mean you'd be a great presenter. And I think it was that people felt a bit awkward in front of the camera. I personally, I wasn't in any thought I'd be a presenter, but it came about because I just couldn't make video work because of the cost implications. We weren't getting the income to match what we were doing. So I thought, well, if I just sucker a camera into the car, a bit like Chris Harris is doing, at least there's no other film crew involved. It's free. So the only way is up. So that's why we ended up doing it was Evo Diaries back then. And that is sort of how it then rolled into where we are today. But for your normal journalist, no, it doesn't mean they're going to be a great presenter, unfortunately.
Do you think that's changed over the last 10, 15 years? And you mentioned photographers as well. Are photographers now trained in video? Can they do both?
They really quite enjoy video. You do get specialists because it's a different set of equipment. You can get hooked on the actual equipment, but drones have been an amazing development for making videos. You know, I remember being in Wales and there was this helicopter came down, we're just on a group test, and they were doing all the footage for Clarkson's last Aston V12 drive across the moors. He'd done it all, the voice to camera. This was several days later and this helicopter arrived and they were doing all the footage. Well, now, you know, I've got a drone sitting over there and it can track me, it can do all sorts of things. So that sort of opened up the possibilities. But it is, as a photographer who does video will also probably do the editing as well. So it's he's not the stills photographers that still exist, and they're doing portraits and obviously shoots as well. But it's the editing bit that they also do that the still photographer didn't do, and that's an essential skill.
So you think after moving through a time when there might have been several in the team that going out to do a car test, we're back to now having one journalist, one photographer, videographer?
We are, because a lot of manufacturers supply a lot of very good photography, so you can get away with that. And if you've got an editor, publisher, and you've got, you know, the sales of magazines, print sales right on the floor, anything to save costs, they're going to use your stock photography an awful lot of the time. But video, unfortunately, needs the presenter in it, and therefore you've got to shoot that. There is no alternative.
Is there a difference between the sort of story development for video and print? I mean, are the fundamental skills of journalism still at its heart? You know, is a great story on YouTube the same as it would be in a well-produced, well-photographed magazine like Evo?
It is, but it's the speed of delivery. Where it trips up. I've just come back from a launch, and I found it quite hard, even after all my experience, if you like, of producing videos, to go on the launch and do the video. You're so time constrained. I was on unfamiliar roads, and I have to think what I'm going to say, how I'm going to present it, what information I get at the start. And I haven't even driven the car yet. And I can remember that I did the first Lamborghini Aventador test for Evo, because it was over a bank holiday, and Chris Harris had booked himself into racing. Dickie had done something else. So Muggins here ended up having to do the first drive of this Aventador. And we rocked up, and Sam Riley afterwards, he said, all right, do the opener and stuff. And I said, well, I haven't even driven it. And it's a very peculiar video, because actually you do need to do your homework. And I can now understand how Top Gear have almost decided, you know, the story. Obviously Richard Porter used to write for us at Evo. And they knew precisely what they were going to say about the car before it even turned up. And you do have to do your homework more with video, because if you're creating a story, you can't wait to get to the launch. You can talk to a few engineers and this and that, then you're going to drive it. Oh, that worked. And used to go to an evening meal, and he said, well, I found you doing that. Oh, that's because of that. And then you redrive it the next day or fly home. But there's a time you can build an opinion of the car and know how it works. Video, instant, now, gone. And it really frustrated me on the launch. I was like, I just wanted the crib sheet, so I absolutely got the horsepower and things right. But there was no information with the car, and I had to do quite a lot of Google work before even doing the opening spiel, because they hadn't thought about putting just the basic information in the car. So I had to find that before presenting. I just took it for read that it would have it.
That's really interesting, because my next question was going to be, do you think PR departments understand that video content creators need to deliver those great stories? And it sounds like we are trying to squeeze new media into old media events.
You just don't understand the pressures on video. Absolutely not. And it is a different situation. I was talking to Steve Sutcliffe on the same launch. He does work for Auto Express. They get around it by doing a lot of voiceover. And so they can correct things and cut if he's got something wrong. He can then do voiceover over the video and use B-roll and get around it like that. For the YouTube generation, we don't have that luxury. There is no sub-editor. There's no editor coming out. We say what we feel about the car, and that's it. It's like a live performance when you're doing video for YouTube. No way of correcting any mistake. So you have to get it right first time, and that's why you want the information, as much information before you actually rock up to the launch as you can.
When you say that it's like a live performance, no way of correcting a mistake, do you not do multiple takes like you would if you're doing for telly?
But I don't know it's wrong, because I'm convinced myself it's 720 horsepower, and I go, oh, it's 620. So I know a famous presenter, and I won't say who it is, but I know the producer, he says, we have him saying every number up to 100, and then all the hundreds, so we can actually correct it when he gets the number wrong, and we have this back catalogue and shove a 6 in there when it was actually, you know, he said 7. So, yeah, there are ways around, but
though it's an instant media. And why, you know, you say, well, why don't you have a sound booth and do that? Well, it's speed. YouTube doesn't reward the high production value type of video. People come at it thinking they're going to produce TV, but a YouTube video is different. It's a soundbite. You're in with him. I explain it to people. Although I'm a journalist and normal road tester, I'm also actually think of it more as a columnist, and that's how you've got to present it. So it's your character, your feel of the car. That's why you're looking at it. And that's how you present a video. So you've got to get the numbers across and stuff. It's why we read a Clarkson column, because you don't know where the journey's going to go. So there's intrigue in there, and that's what you've got to build into the video. It's a different skill set. And if you're doing a report for a magazine, it's a first drive or it's a group test or whatever it is, but then it's sub-edited, it's filtered, and then it's built in, and it's under the title of Evo. So the character of the writer is in a group of people. YouTube is a very personal thing. It's the one person you are watching. There's no one else involved, and that's how to do it. That's what's in the back of my mind whenever I present a video.
So your feeling is that people watch you because they like your style. They like the way you present the facts, the research that you do. It's not because they want to see something about the latest Hyundai or Aston Martin.
I hate talking it in that way, but I'm a car enthusiast. And you're sharing the passion. That's at the back of it. That's all I'm trying to do, and I can't wait to tell the story. And sometimes you get something absolutely fantastic, and you're just bubbling over with enthusiasm. Like Ferrari Porosangue, I went out do the launch of. Because I was intrigued by that car. Ferrari doing a four-door, it's got some radical suspension on it, active suspension, first time really on a production car. My only way of driving it was to go out on the launch, or I waited a year to come back here, and I thought, it's too long a time, I will go out and have a drive in it. So it was 9 years since I've been to an international launch. I did VW Buzz down the road as well, which was just before Christmas. I want to tell a story. I'm a car enthusiast. I can't wait to drive that new Ferrari. So yeah, that's my mentality when I'm creating a video.
Do you find that you're just going back to your experience on Evo, that you were creating two different stories? So there's one story theme for print and another one that will work better on YouTube.
Yeah, there was a bit of that, because you can see it and hear it, and it's, you know, that bit you have to express in words. Well, you almost don't have to express it in words because you've actually got that happening in front of you. I've moved to doing YouTube and rather than magazines, because I think it's the media of the future. We're a lazy lot, and I think magazines are declining because it actually takes effort to read a magazine. You know, for you have to find a copy, you have to turn the page, you have to light some stuff. YouTube is just that. It's like how Amazon is sort of taken over how we shop, and we all have our mobile phones and we have desktops, etc. And we stumble across a video and we have no effort to then absorb what this car is about, and then it will suggest another one, and another will pop out, and it's. That's why it's proving so popular. And I think, from a magazine point of view, it is hard. It's going to, I think it's going to get niche, magazine, more and more niche. And YouTube is always there, and it's very good at suggesting another video for you to watch. And you say, well, that's quite good, actually. And I've done it, analytics behind it is nuts.
Yeah, you can disappear into a YouTube wormhole, which is very harder easy. And you can watch it anywhere. You can watch it as you're waiting for your aeroplane, or I watch your videos when I'm in the gym. Just pop the phone up, put the headphones on.
And you wouldn't do that with a paper magazine.
No, I wouldn't take a copy of Evo and sit on the cycle with it.
No, there's one place where again, it doesn't happen. And I look back at magazines and think, did we really do that? It's like I used to print, I think it was 50 tons of magazines in physical bulk paper, and about 20 tons we used to send to the States, and did we airship it, and there's Australia, and and I wouldn't get sales figures back for months on those overseas sales. And a really good sell-through rate was 60% in the UK. We get up to 60. So then you think, well, 40% were pulped.
Mm.
It's really quite a wasteful industry looking back. And what I love about YouTube is I press live, publish, and it is then global instantly. And it never goes off sale. And I don't think PRs realise, or automotive realise, just the power of putting a video out. It's why I take such care. I like a car here for a week. Because if I publish a test on a whatever, KN is the next one going out, Turbo GT, I'm not going to do it again. I'm not. It's not first drive. It's not the UK drive. That is my test on that car. End of. It has to live forever. So you have to be, another difference between a magazine and YouTube. If you do a review of a car, you have to be proud of it. That's why I have it for a week. I can live with it. I can make sure the weather's okay. I hate doing videos in the rain. Why have you done it in the rain? It has to be perfect conditions, and that's your review and your opinion of that car. We need to move on to another.
You've mentioned some of the challenges with going to events and vehicle launches.
Yeah.
What's your advice for PR departments thinking about the next event?
It's hard, isn't it? What works video is, I like, what intrigues me is the walk arounds of a new car seem to be particularly well received on YouTube. It's that access we get, and you can talk around it, not an opinion on the car, but it tells you quite a lot of the car if you're interested in that car. So I find those first ones are very powerful. It surprised me. I did, Ferrari Purosangue in December. It was 3 months after first time people walked around that car. It did 1 million views in 5 weeks. Why was that? I mean, it's been out there, that information to be out, but there is intrigue around new car. So they seem to be as a medium, is very good. But when I go on a launch, what I struggled with was the rush to get things done. And a YouTuber like me, solo camera, perhaps my son helped me on that one. We don't know the roads. We don't know where we're going to do the tracking. I've got to do the intro. It is so compressed compared to a normal shoot. And if you're then doing the high production values, and I'm thinking of, Auto Trader or Haggerty taking over from Carfection, I can present to the camera there, but there's enough of a team there to do the B-roll and the details and all the beauty shots. But it is very tight to do in a day, extremely tight. And I would suggest to anyone who's inviting video versus a print journalist, think which has the most value to the brand of the two journals you're coming on. Forget old mates, etc. Just put it into analytics. And I would suggest a video that instantly goes global. If I'm English-speaking video, it has a very wide audience. The last year, I was 37.6% UK views and then States 16.6%. So 65% or 63% of my views are outside the UK. And I don't think manufacturers quite get that it is a massive reach if you're on YouTube and a successful YouTuber. It's very different to a UK-based magazine. But we both get the same time to create that content. And I think it should be more valued than it is. I know it's a pain, but have a look what you're trying to do. Why you're doing this is to get the word out how great your car is. Well, I would suggest YouTube gets it out there quicker than a UK-only based magazine. Unfortunately.
Yeah, and as you said earlier, it also stays there and people keep finding it. When they're looking for reviews on a particular car, you're there. And when we looked at the ongoing viewings of your videos, it's really impressive.
Yeah, and that's the tale. Yeah.
The UK market, just 38% of your considerable audience is still more than every print publication.
I suppose it is. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, it's peculiar how popular YouTube is. It's not just me, it's others. You know, Henry's doing a great job, Hackerty, etc. But the other thing, even little old me is bigger than Automotor and Sport German channel. They put a video out every day, but I've got more subscribers and I get more views per month than they do. And that is the beauty of the UK YouTuber type. It is a global reach, and I don't think that message has got in the office. And there is, you can check any channel by, there's a great website called Social Blade, and if you just Google Social Blade, they monitor every YouTube and Instagram. You can put anything in, but for YouTube I use it, and I have a group of folks, and you, there's no hiding on YouTube. Analytics are everywhere, and Social Blade will tell you exactly how many views that channel you're thinking of inviting, what they're doing, and subscriber base, and how many views a day they get. And that, I think, is a very good guide, a useful guide for manufacturers. And they should also ask a YouTuber, tell me where your audience is, what age your audience is, how many views you get, because YouTube provide 24/7 analytics to the nth degree on anything you ask. They have those at their fingertips. It's not like a magazine does a reader survey and then the ads teams are trying to, you know, pump up the figures you want to hear. There's no hiding on YouTube, and I think it's a tool that's completely untouched by manufacturers when they're doing the invite.
Can they give you a breakdown by, you mentioned age, they could give you an age profile for your readers?
So I can tell you, in the last 365 days, yes, 17.1% of my audience, 24 to 34, 35 to 44 is 21%, 45 to 55, 24%, 55 to 64, 18%. So, yeah, it is absolutely, and I could tell you what audience watched that test of the whatever I've reviewed, the Honda Civic Type R. I can tell you precisely the age within a day, who's viewed it and where they were. So, again, manufacturers never ask those questions, but they could, and I think most of you should be over grateful to do it, because it just shows the impact they've got and why the audience is.
Yes, I think that's a really important point. And we do all need to understand the demographic to justify the budgets now.
Well, yes.
Because we always get, the CEO will always say, an extra 2 days on this event, that's very expensive. Can you justify it in terms of return on investment? And yeah, you're saying that we can, because we've got the data available. Well, we just have to ask.
Well, you have. And my dilemma is, much as I love to produce the high standards of Hackerty, Carl Fetchen and Auto Trader Roy, I just came back. I did Audi invite me out to see the Dakar rally, and I just checked before you came, and I got an outside video guide to help me do that one. It was £1,000 for the 2 days, £500 a day. I looked at its ad revenue, and it's done £998.34. So I've earned £1.63 from doing that event. And that's the dilemma as a YouTuber. God, how much do I spend on the production values? If I'm absolutely reliant on the YouTube income, I've got to watch my spend. So if you do a 2-day launch, am I actually going to get that benefit? What I would say is, instead of doing a 2-day launch, still do the 1 day, but feed more info at the beginning, so he comes, whoever's coming out of the film is fully prepared, knows the route, what they're going to do, the good bits, so they can pre-plan where they're going to go and where they're going to do that filming. It doesn't matter if you're a print journal, because you just go out and you want to drive the car. A YouTuber needs much more preparation, and then you can still do it in a day, but it's the advanced information that would be really useful. And also, like supplying the B-roll, so I know what B-roll I've got, so I don't have to shoot that, because you can supply that, all details. So anything like that, I want to see that in advance before going on the launch.
That's really interesting. So are you saying that we should be going and recceing the routes for also things like the quality of the scenery, the drama, things that are exciting on a video that aren't necessarily needed for print?
Yes, that's because it's a visual medium. It's things that are tricky to do on your own. Are front and rear tracking, for example. So get plenty of front and rear tracking, and don't, it's the multitude of colours of cars doesn't help.
What colours would you prefer?
I wouldn't, just not black, not grey, something that vibes out. Think of, you've got to do that thumbnail, he's going to be against grey tarmac and stuff. I need something that's going to punch out so they can see what car it is. Mm. Minimise the number of colours of cars on the video so you're not complicated. Well, give the video guys the cars that you have done the tracking and details of, but make them aware of those shots, and then they know they've got that in the bag, so they all have to do is rabbit on in the car.
You mentioned tracking and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Would it help if the PR departments provided people to help with things like car to car? If we had a team of...
Well, just do it at a lunch stop. If you do a lunch stop and there's a dead straight bit of road, that's the bit where you can do the front and rear tracking, because you're based there, and you just go up and down, and it's bagged. Something I've discovered in doing these videos, your best friend is B-roll, because B-roll can cover up your mistakes and the joins in the video, etc. So the more access you have to B-roll, the better. And that you do multitude of, you know, it's nice to have in two or three camera angles in the front. The last thing people will want to watch is me. They want to see the car. So the more B-roll I have, the happier I am.
Just in terms of collateral, do you think the vehicle manufacturers provide enough of the technical detail? When I was watching, for example, your Defender review,
yeah,
and you cut in a what presumably was provided by Land Rover, a really nice cutaway that showed the hybrid system and the lightweight body construction. Is there enough of that?
No, I'm addicted to that sort of stuff. I just think the picture tells 1,000 words. I don't have to show engine position or whatever. No, that stuff is really nice to drop in. And I shouldn't be a lost art. Otherwise, everything's pretty. We're heading for... This is where we differ. There is an Instagram generation that everything has to be pretty pictures and environment and lovely. There's still a huge audience who like the details on this stuff. And you don't seem to put off the people who aren't that interested in it, because they're not having to make any effort. You know, they're still watching, there's still dialogue going, there's a picture, they're not really sure what it is, and then it moves on to a pretty picture again. So it doesn't have a negative effect on the video, but I think it enhances it, because it tells you know more about the subject, you've learned something from a video. I want people to learn something. At the end of the video, they know more about that car, and they knew something they'd never realised it had that widget, or did that, or, you know. I love that stuff.
Do you think interest in the technology is growing with electric vehicles? Because my perception is that they're still relatively early, that people who buy them tend to be interested in, you know, they know about battery capacities and range and energy densities. And is that driving a need for more technical data for those vehicles?
I think we're going to get... I don't think it is, actually. I think electric, there's just fundamentals they want to know. And... It's range and power and performance. I think they are going to be tricky to do videos on. We're going to end up in a sort of what car world just on, well, how far is it going and things. Because the dilemma I find when I get an electric car in, I can't describe sort of engine sound. I can't describe front, rear, weight distribution, handling. It's because they're all generally skateboard and 50-50 and... All the hooks that you've got used to describe for the last 30 years disappear. It just gets really quick, and it's tend to be four-wheel drive. So, I think it's going to be very interesting where we are in 10 years' time trying to do reviews of new electric cars. What are we going to be... Are they going to be as fun as doing the GT3 or something? It's a hard one for manufacturers. How are they going to make their cars exciting? Another thing I think manufacturers don't think about is the opportunity of doing video is way beyond just doing the car review. I'm trying to find someone to invite me to Le Mans, do behind the scenes at Le Mans. The Dakar one, yes, I'm grumbling, it didn't actually earn anything, but it was great video to watch and see up close. And so I think it's more of what the brand means and what activity they're up to beyond just the road test of the new widget, I think is a very good way to engage with YouTubers, because they're not always of great interest to magazines, because they never know how many pages to put on it. But readers or viewers like it. So they just it just works better doing a behind-the-scenes review of a big event than it does in print.
Yes.
It just looks like a Johnny.
And it also it gives the viewer the feeling that they're somewhere special, that they're accompanying you behind the scenes.
Behind the scenes. Tours of the private collections of manufacturing things. They're always really popular, as well as, you know, just the first drive. So I think they're missing a trick there that might not go down with the magazines, because they have to get so many first drives, because the ad teams want the new drives, and a different driver completely.
Is the age range of viewers different for your electric car material to your classic car or new car material?
I have to come back to you on that one, because I have not checked, actually, whether that is any different. But it's very much a buyer. There is a... I don't like the way electric cars have gone a bit tribal. And we do have the, you know, Tesla gang, and they're really good. The weirdness from a magazine point of view, there's no press fleet, so Teslas are quite hard to test, while I can test any number of electric cars from other brands, so that's quite an interesting one. But the user experience, Tesla are so big in the market, it's just odd that they have no, you know, they don't lend cars out anymore. But yeah, electric cars is something I tend not to do. I have the experience of the older cars, and I just love revisiting. If you want, you know, going back to Harry's garage, they're getting historic fleets together. There was a whole wonderful age of cars, brilliant cars. You know, you'd love your 944 outside. There was no video on that car at all, because we didn't do video back then. There's lots of articles. You can go and get Fastlane, etc. So I'm revisiting those past heroes as something I really enjoy doing. And there are heritage fleets now being built up, the manufacturers, which I think enhance the brand and why the brand stands for what it does. So that's another access point, I think, for video, is to do those. You've got to be careful there, because some new road testers have never even driven a car without power steering, for example, in a manual. So it's you've got to have the right person doing it, I suppose, to realise what that car was and why it's like that.
And you're right. The perceptions of what is good steering change with time.
Yes.
And it's not just that the perceptions change, but it's also what people expect, I think, changed. I remember doing some really interesting work with ProDrive on this, and they were saying, you know, us as car enthusiasts, we define good steering in a completely different way to the average buyer of a small SUV.
The steering feel is one of those that you've got to be careful on, because something I always accuse guys at Evo when I was there, he says, stop writing for other motor journalists, you're writing for the potential buyer of this car. Do not forget that. He's not so, you know, so concentrated on the steering feel. He wants to know about space in the car, and does it fit, and how is it too wide for the roads, or how is it, you know, steering feel is an element, but it's not the most critical thing. Otherwise, I said, we'll just end up reviewing caterums every day.
Yes. 10 out of 10 steering feel.
Yeah.
Just going back to events.
Yeah.
One of the things that's happened through my career is everything has become more time critical. So at the beginning of my career, we'd invite the journalists along, we'd have a terrific event, and then in the evening we'd have a lovely dinner with the executives, and then all the journalists would head off to the hospitality room. The senior PR guys would go to bed so they're nice and fresh in the morning, and us junior guys would entertain them until 2 o'clock and all the booze had gone.
Yeah.
But nowadays, you go on an event, and even at lunchtime, I just have some sandwiches because I've got to write this up for the internet. I've got to be, you know, it's got to be online in half an hour.
Yeah.
Because YouTube is a medium that just stays around, and you say you've got this long tail. Do you have that same time criticality? Do you try and be the first out with the noise and the sound and the emotion of this car?
Personally, I don't. Others do, but I have no interest in being first. I just want to make sure I can live with it properly and tell you all about it, and I will wait until I can do that moment. So Ineos, if you like, you know, got invited up to the north. No, I don't want to do that in Scotland. I want to try it here. I know the roads. I want something repeatable so you can compare my road test against something else rather than just being at that launch. The bit I miss from the launches is meeting the guys who created that car. And that is extremely valuable information, and just to get a feel of it. And yeah, I can't say I like the current obsession with doing that. And you get around it with the embargoes and things, I suppose, on certain products. But even then, it just feels odd that this sudden outpouring. I don't know what the model is, how we get to that, what you do.
Maybe invite less people on the launch, I would suggest, and maybe control it better and not do the spend. Are you actually going to get more pages and more coverage if you go out to Miami or do it in the UK? Well, I don't think there's going to be much difference, actually. So I sometimes wonder if some of the really elaborate launches are done more for the marketing team because they just want to go there, or for actually what they're producing. I'm not sure if it
that's really interesting, because I would have assumed that having, as a video content creator, having a glamorous, beautiful backdrop would be important to you.
Well, quite a lot of it is in car. You're just racing around. It's your opinion. Going back to Mr. Clarkson again, he just does it on the same roads as me. You know, he gets massive coverage on his columns, you know, his opinion. You think it needs that, but it doesn't always need that that amount of travelling. And it adds so many days, and I have to get a video out every week. And if I spent 4 days travelling to do one car, I probably won't do it, because it's just not worth it. So, no, it doesn't interest me. Because, again, you haven't got a team producing a magazine. It's just you, and it's down to you. And a lot of us YouTubers do the editing as well. So we've got to get back and edit it and get one out. And how do we do that if we're on a four-day launch?
Unsurprisingly, Harry's coffee is excellent. So there is more conversation and some fascinating comments about how communicators can work more effectively with new media in the next episode. If you're a truck specialist interested in Harry's farm, there's a question to Harry specifically for you. See you there.